When we get into LISCO, we have an opportunity to focus our assets based on what we know the terrain will allow them to do. The Russians make very good maps, very detailed maps, but the question is, will they be willing to give this level of information at the lowest level?
This is The Convergence, the Army's Mad Scientist podcast. I'm Matt Sanisbert, Deputy Director of Mad Scientists, and I'll be joined in just a moment by our Mad Sci intern, Aldrin Yashko. Mad Scientist is a U.S. Army initiative that continually explores the evolution of warfare, challenges assumptions, and collaborates with academia, industry, and government. You can connect with us on social media at @ArmyMadSci, and don't forget to subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. On today's episode, we're talking with Jason Fesser, Army veteran and branch chief for the Data and Generation Production Branch in the Warfighter Support Division of the Army Geospatial Center. We'll be talking with Jason about the Army Geospatial Center, the role emerging and advanced technology plays, and the capabilities of our most important adversaries. As always, the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Army Futures Command, or the Training and Doctrine Command. Let's get started.
Jason, thanks so much for being on the show.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. Longtime fan of the podcast, and I'm excited to be a part of the community.
Awesome. Well, we're excited to have you here. So before we get started talking about the big topic today, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and then how you got to where you are today?
My name is Jason Fesser. I'm a branch chief at the Army Geospatial Center. As opposed to my background and how I got here, two completely different things, but I'll address them both. I enlisted in the Army back in 1992, right out of high school at age 17, and have been a geospatial engineer since 1994. I've been assigned to multiple heavy divisions, 2nd Infantry Division, 3rd Infantry Division, 1st Infantry Division, as a terrain analyst, MOS 81 Quebec, before we transitioned much later to the geospatial titles. I've been assigned to the Army Geospatial Center, and then had the good fortune of being assigned to the Stryker Brigade combat teams for about 7 years, both 125 Stryker as they transformed out of a light infantry to brigade, and then 2nd Cavalry Regiment. We moved from Fort Lewis back to Vilsack. Number of deployments in Iraq during those 7 years, and then went on to U.S. Army South with the 512th Geospatial Planning Cell, also the JAC in Molesworth, England, and then ended my career at the Army Geospatial Center as the military advisor to the director of AGC. How I got here, I would say I got here by the benefit of a lot of great leaders in my career. As a young geospatial analyst, a terrain analyst, engaging with senior leaders, having them empower me to find new and exciting ways to engage with the staff, answer questions, deliver solutions, really opened the door for me and helped me understand that the Army is where I belonged. So that's how I got here. I've had a number of great leaders who have guided me along the way. And if you'll just indulge me real quick, I'd like to point out that Lieutenant General Jones is retiring on the 31st of July. Great leader. One of the leaders that really influenced me through my career. And it'll be a big loss to the Army once he retires.
Many of our listeners might not be familiar with the Army Geospatial Center. Could you tell us a little bit about that organization, its purpose, and how it supports warfighters and the Joint Force?
Sure. To understand the Army Geospatial Center, I think I'd start with the geospatial engineers. The MOS 12 Yankees and the 125 Deltas are the warrant officers across the force. Geospatial engineers are embedded in formations across our force structures, from brigade combat teams all the way up to the Army Service Component Commands, typically located with the S2s and the G2s and the ACE, but they can also be found under the engineer or the S3 G3. Geospatial engineers do the analysis that contribute to GEOINT in support of the command and staff, and their principal job is to help surface the elements of the operational environment that'll impact operations. Typically, we think of terrain when we think of impact operations, but it can include any number of aspects that include cultural, institutional, or physical aspects of the environment that will work against our forces across multiple domains. Geospatial engineers pull those critical aspects out of the environment for the staff, kind of like a needle and thread through multiple staff processes like MDMP, IPB, targeting. The Army Geospatial Center supports those geospatial engineers and the Army staff by providing critical data sets, critical services necessary to support everything from the command and control systems, broad area analysis, and specialized products to help decision makers and geospatial engineers across the force. We support and service anyone in the DoD that has questions or issues related to the terrain, to the operational environment, but our customer base is principally the Army and Army units. AGC is principally divided into two divisions. The first division is the Systems Acquisition Support Division, and the second is the Warfighter Support Division, where I work. SASD, Systems and Acquisition Support Division, is principally oriented around challenges that deal with modeling and simulation, GWINT system acquisition, policy, and standards. They do a lot of work for PEO IAWS within the GWINT space, and they also work generating common terrain backgrounds for modeling and sim. The Warfighter Support Division, which is the division that I work in, has five branches. Those branches include the collections branch, which generates high-resolution EO and 3D data. We have the engagement branch, which focuses on RFIs and keeping 12 Yankees and 125 Deltas across all three compos up to speed on the latest and greatest technology through training events. We have the operational resilience branch, which is they hold the DoD's mission for groundwater and liquid logistics support. So finding where we can drill wells anywhere around the world and making sure we have water for our troops. I'm the branch chief for the data generation and production branch, which is to say that we build large scale data sets to support mapping anywhere from the 1 to 5,000 all the way up to 1 to 50,000 scale map products. We have three lines of productions, which is part of the Intel Mission Product Guide. We have the Engineer Route Study, we have the Regional Terrain Planner, and then we have the Urban Tactical Planner. All three products are produced in my branch, and as well as the supporting data. So collectively, AGC supports over 140,000 mission command systems with map data and products. In an average year, we deliver the rough equivalent of the Library of Congress map data and products to warfighters around the globe. And then we support all the command and control systems in terms of testing, evaluating, and making sure these maps work properly and can support the warfighter however they need.
So it sounds like you're doing a lot there, and it sounds like there's a lot of capability at the Army Geospatial Center. Tell us a little bit about the technology that allows these capabilities to unfold. So you talked about, you know, pulling the thread, building these data sets. What tech are you using to get this data?
So we use a number of geospatial information systems, the most common of which is made by a company called Esri. But we use geospatial information systems to extract data from imagery, from tabular data, from unstructured data. But we build databases of information that are tied to the Earth's surface. These are spatially relevant sources of information. It could be in the terms of vector data, which is points, lines, and polygons that are tied to attributes. So vector data has geometries, which are tied to, if you think of a spreadsheet, a row in a spreadsheet would be tied to a geometry. And then the columns of information in that spreadsheet hold descriptors of that geometry. So you would have a road line, but the columns of information would describe how wide it is, what it's made of. Is that road on a bridge? It could be a hydro line. It could be a forest, right? So that's vector data. We have raster data that's either representing satellite imagery or elevation data. We have LIDAR is a form of elevation data where we fly aircraft and scan the Earth with a laser beam to determine the altitude of different features or the elevation of different features. So there's a lot of different data types that goes into a geospatial information system. And all of this data can be associated with activities or the impacts of the environment on those activities. We could also use it to quantify things. So if you've ever gone to Google Maps and you're like, I want to go to this establishment to buy something, and you'll see that little bar chart at the bottom that shows when it's most active at that store, right? That's geospatial information in the background tied to your phone. What Google does is it says how many phones are in the store at any given time of day. And then they transform that information into a little chart that you see there. When you go into Jason's furniture warehouse, it'll show you when the busiest times are based on the collection of phones in that location. Another good example of it, of geospatial information systems, is delivering packages for FedEx, UPS, your grocery store card. Your address that's tied to your account for your discount is tied to the store's catchment area. So what stores do is they track what you buy, they match that up with demographics, and then they streamline their logistics from the warehouse to the store based on what everybody in that demographic is likely to buy. So GIS can be used in any number of ways to describe the environment, to describe how the environment will impact our lives or operations. And it's a really fascinating field to be a part of.
That's really interesting. And it's kind of amazing to see how many normal day-to-day things that we do as civilians are impacted by the geospatial area. So we, and when I say we, I mean, the TRADOC G2, the Army in general, have focused recently on large-scale combat operations. There's been kind of a shift towards that in recent years. This is based on insights that we've gleaned from contemporary conflicts, and we even based our annual assessment, the Operational Environment 2024 to 2034, on that idea. How does that affect geospatial analysis, if at all?
I think for the geospatial community, this is a return to what we were engaged in prior to the coin fight, prior to September 11th. A lot of what we did as geospatial engineers was codified in a number of FMs that date back to like the 1970s. FM 30-10 is an example, military intelligence of terrain, or 5-33, terrain analysis. All of that was geared towards a high intensity conflict. If you think back to that time frame, there weren't drones. We didn't have shadows or preds or reapers or any of those other types of full motion video. But as a staff, we had to come together and figure out what is the enemy going to do within this battle space, this operational space, and how are they going to do it? One of the key limiting factors that drives how any force will operate within the battle space is the terrain. There's three neutral factors on the battlefield. It's terrain, time, and weather. Right. And all these three things kind of come together that it can be evaluated in an objective way to understand how the enemy is going to fight with any operational space. What I like to tell people is that within any operational space, there's battlefield geometry and then there's operational trigonometry. Battlefield geometry describes the width and depth of any engagement area. And then the operational trigonometry that sits on top of that is how any force can be arrayed according to their doctrine, within the constraints of how the terrain will limit them. So where will this tank be? Doctrinally, 50 meters from another tank along the front line, given this specific type of mission, whether it's a defense, movement to contact, or attack, or whatever it is. How those tanks are oriented and how far apart they are is constrained by the terrain, slope, hydrology, soil type, weather, how long did it rain? Is the soil still wet? How will that affect operations? How will that tank be able to maneuver across the terrain? These are all aspects that can be tied up in that relationship between terrain and how any force will maneuver doctrinally within that space. And so when we talk about large-scale combat operations, it's kind of a return to that environment where we really dig into the terrain and start talking about all the things that they can't do in order to elevate to the surface all the things that are possibilities for them to do. This is radically different than what we've done in the coin fight, where we had to have sensors everywhere. We had to see everything all the time, everywhere, all at once. Lots of video feeds, lots of real-time feeds. But when we get into LISCO, we have an opportunity to focus our assets based on what we know the terrain will allow them to do. And doctrinally, how that enemy formation is organized, how they operate within any given mission profile. So if you're a fighting force that doesn't have a lot of logistics, you will tend to fight your fight within the scope of where you can support your logistics if you're missing a certain layer. The Russian Army has a lot of organic and strategic logistics, but are missing that operational layer. So when you talk about how they fight, you would expect to see them fight along those lines of communication that will fill in that gap for that operational layer. That kind of provides some insight that can be elevated within the staff as we go through course of action development, mission analysis, and ultimately through X-Hour.
It's notable that you mentioned drones and sensors, because one of the key insights from many of the contemporary conflicts that we're witnessing today is that there's been a massive proliferation of drones and unmanned vehicles. Could you talk a little bit about how these technologies are affecting geospatial data, or conversely, how geospatial data is affecting these new technologies?
So let's talk about how terrain will affect these unmanned and remote piloted systems. Terrain, as we talk about what a drone can and cannot do, is going to be a very vital part of any autonomous system that we decide to employ in, within the operational space. A few episodes ago, we heard from somebody who fought in the Ukraine fight. The logical answer to that kind of situation is to provide these drones and unmanned systems with a highly detailed, high resolution understanding of the terrain so that they can conduct specific tasks even when they do not have access to that remote pilot or remote operator to tell them to go this way or that way. And this gets compounded as the operational space becomes more and more dirty, if you will. Road craters, minefields, different operational situations, down bridges. If we don't take the time now to consider how these drones and unmanned systems will operate without that remote connection to our pilots and operators, what we will find is that we will have soldiers moving to the front line, driving past a number of unmanned assets that have been rolled over, tipped, caught in a ditch, because they didn't have that high fidelity understanding of what the battle space looks like. And that high fidelity understanding of that battle space wasn't updated on a frequent basis. How these drones will affect terrain and geospatial information is that we have an opportunity to collect a lot of information as we saturate the operational environment with all these sensors. The intersection of any two sensors, three sensors by modality, whether that's EO, LIDAR, maybe it's radar, or any other type of source of sensor that they may be operating off of, if it can be backhauled into the operational center, into some sort of cloud repository or node within that operational theater, then we can take that data and synthesize a better understanding of the operational space at a truly high fidelity. The intersection of these different types of modalities will expose a lot of details that may not be evident from just a map or just from satellite imagery or any other resource. So terrain analysis, geospatial analysis will shift as these drones saturate the operational environment. And the results will be quite interesting. Recently, I had an engagement with a commercial partner who is working on embedding multiple modalities into a single satellite image. And what that'll give you is the opportunity to understand 15 modalities for every 10 meters of imagery that you see. So for every pixel, they have embedded 15 different modalities, LIDAR, elevation, they've embedded EO, radar, and they've also embedded a gravity map, which is something you can actually map gravity. Gravity's not the same around the world. So they've embedded all these different sources of information into a single pixel, and it creates a 64-bit description of that 10-meter space that becomes very, very specific and can be used to answer some very, very specific questions about the impact of the environment on operations. So when we talk about sensors, we talk about AI and some of the new technologies that are coming out, the future is pretty exciting from the sense that we will be able to pull in a vast quantity of information. The question is, can we turn that information around quickly and use it and leverage it against anyone that we face within the operational space?
So I would like to talk about artificial intelligence, as you brought up, but you kind of piqued my interest when you said that one of those layers in that pixel is mapping gravity. Why would we want to know that? How does that help us?
First, we have to understand that gravity is not equal around the Earth's surface, right? A lot of effort and a lot of math is spent to calculate gravity as a equilibrium across the Earth so we can make some general calculations a lot easier. Everything from flight of ammunition from artillery shells to the sniper bullet. We use some very generalized values to represent gravity. But that calculation comes from understanding it's a mean value between all the differences in gravity. A number of things that can affect gravity, water is a big one. When China dammed the Three Rivers Gorge and created that huge water reservoir, it drastically shifted the gravity in that area. Whenever you have wet areas, wet soils, you will find that gravity increases as opposed to when it's dry, if it's in a large geographic area. Gravity also is also subjected by altitude, materials in the Earth's surface. There's a lot of different things that will affect gravity. And a lot of agencies have models, a lot of civilian organizations have models that define gravity specific, generally within a kilometer, what the variance is from the norm.
Wow, that's really interesting. I didn't even think about that. But I do want to jump back to artificial intelligence and machine learning. They're kind of buzzwords at this point, but there is applicability in them in certain circumstances. You guys are dealing with really big data sets when you were talking about how many modalities there were in the previous answer. So how are you, if at all, integrating artificial intelligence and machine learning into what you're doing with geospatial analysis?
We're doing a lot of research within the geospatial community writ large, not just the Army, but in academia and industry. There are some challenges. Right now, for example, AIML is unable to read and associate vector geometries with attributes, the vector data that we use in GIS. But AIML is going to have a major impact on geospatial analysis and the value of geospatial information in the operational environment in numerous ways. So just starting with foundational operations, talking about generating data, the first impact will be how and to what fidelity we can generate content. When you think about features like hydrology, like a river, and the impact of a river on operations, we need a lot of detailed data to make assessments like flood risk, dam breaches, wet gap crossing. All of hydrology creates a major obstacle and hazard to troops on the battlefield. So we're talking about safety issues. We're talking about operational tempo. So some of the details that we need to extract include information like the bank height, the bank slope, the width of the river, the depth of the river, the water velocity, and the bottom materials. That's just a small sampling of the type of information that we have to have on hydrology features. So extracting that information is extremely time consuming, and it's very, very expensive from a labor standpoint. So even if we were to just buy this data set from commercial vendor, it'll be a very expensive data set. Generating the data on our own from a time standpoint is a very expensive data set to make. So way I see AIML impacting foundational operation is that we should be able to apply these different algorithms to observations, whether it's EO, satellite imagery, or radar, or some other, or LIDAR, some other type of data set, or maybe all of those data sets, to bring that data together and create those detailed understanding of the river that we need to use in our assessments. So when we talk about the cost, there's also a cost in terms of operation. If we have to do the assessment, if a geospatial engineer has to do that assessment while they're in the fight, right? There's a cost in terms of the level of fidelity and the scope of the analysis that they can do within the time frame of MDMP and IPB. If you're in an abbreviated MDMP, you only have 8 hours, you only may get a very narrow section of the river assessed to do these types of analysis. So from a foundational standpoint, AIML should help us get entire watersheds, multiple rivers, that will allow staff to plan in depth across multiple wet gap crossings if necessary and get after their operational tempo, soldier safety, and get after any humanitarian missions that are necessary in terms of droughts, flooding, and other natural disasters. The other way this is going to help us is a lot of discrete data classification. When we look at common products that we create now, like helicopter landing zones, for example, helicopter landing zones require us to overlay multiple types of vertical obstructions. And I'm talking about power lines, towers, antennas, and trees. We take that data, we overlay it with slope, soil type, soil moisture. All of these things come together, and analysts intersect all of those layers to determine where the suitable values line up on the terrain. We need to quantify the amount of area that is suitable to determine if this can be used as a helicopter landing zone. That entire process is based off of very generalized vector data. And what I mean by that is you may have forests as a data set, but you don't have individual trees, and you may not have details of those individual trees, like its height, its canopy, diameter, what type of tree it is. Maybe that information is relevant in that part of the world to selecting a helicopter landing zone. So when we talk about AIML impacting geospatial data and geospatial analysis, we should be able to get additional, from a math standpoint, additional places to the right of the decimal. And that additional fidelity, those additional points to the right of the decimal place, will enable us to find better, more accurate assessments of where to land a helicopter, for example, or to conduct a wet gap crossing. So all of this data classification, data analysis, data generation, it all ties back to the foundational aspect of how AIML will impact what we're doing. The operational applications on the other side of that coin are going to benefit from the interaction between AIML and geospatial analysis and geospatial data. When we discussed drones and unmanned ground vehicles in a recent podcast, you interviewed someone who was in Ukraine. We talked about the level of effort that the Russian forces were using EW to prevent drones from penetrating their lines. As we achieve a higher level of fidelity in geospatial data, we should be able to support autonomous or semi-autonomous vehicles and drones. What this gives us is when the drone or when the vehicle loses contact due to active jamming or simply a loss of signal, that vehicle or drone should be able to continue operations until they can reestablish comms with whoever's operating the vehicle or the drone. We're already seeing a lot of complex decision-making in congested environments with autonomous taxis driving in major cities. We see articles about blood being delivered in London and Rwanda using drones. And when we take those complex operational environments, the technology that is navigating those environments, one of the common things is they have a very clear understanding of the terrain in very high detail. We have an additional problem within the operational space. So we have to consider the dirty operational environment. We have to think about things like road craters, minefields, down bridges. We have to think about the enemy itself. So we have to be able to develop technologies that will allow AIML algorithms to interact with this high resolution terrain data as a foundation, and then compare that data to what they're seeing within the operational space with their various sensors, right? The spatial relationship between any given vehicle and its environment will need to be managed on a geospatial foundation. More importantly, we have to backhaul those observations. We can't just let these vehicles out there or these drones out there with these high resolution sensors and not backhaul that information to update our understanding of the dirty operational space. If there's a new road crater and we've got a semi-autonomous logistics train going down that road, it may be able to navigate that crater individually, but if we don't backhaul that information, no one else within the formation will be able to benefit from that knowledge. I went to AUSA and saw that the Abram X is replete with LiDAR sensors and cameras. That's a lot of information that can be collected. It's the same amount of information my Audi collects, right? It has LiDAR sensors and cameras. So what are we going to do with that information? Where's it going to go? How do we conflate it? And AIML should help us conflate that data at scale. It should help the individual vehicle navigate those obstacles. And then it should also feed our planning process and our ability to plan against enemy anywhere, anytime, and get inside their decision space. So the last portion is the simulation that can happen in support of the staff, whether it's inside the MDMP process or inside the IPV process or even the targeting process. The high resolution terrain data will afford us the opportunity to run numerous simulations on enemy courses of action. We could test those courses of action in a simulation that is constrained by terrain and based on real-time observations. And this will be critical to getting us inside the enemy's decision space. I mentioned before that when we take the enemy doctrine, real-time observations, and the limitations of terrain, we have an operational trigonometry that helps us predict where to find other vehicles or high-value targets. By running simulations in real time, the command and staff will be able to look further into the operational future and anticipate every move in depth over time. If we're looking for a specific high payoff target, or if we're looking for a specific high value target, and it hasn't made itself known within the operational space, these simulations will help us understand when we can anticipate it to appear and where it will appear in space and time. And that's going to be a very important aspect of AIML and the convergence of high resolution terrain data and geospatial analysis.
That all does sound very exciting, and it's crazy to think that the kinds of capabilities that you're describing are soon going to be feasible. We've talked a lot about what we as an army are doing to utilize geospatial data, but I'd wonder what our adversaries are doing and what you think we can be doing to counter their efforts.
Let me start with an anecdote, and I think this kind of is important to understand. A lot of our near peers don't believe in the same level of command and control at the lowest level that we do. In my experience, when we went into Kosovo, the U.S. sector Task Force Falcon had a Russian battalion assigned to it as part of the entry force. The Russian battalion was right on that scene between the U.S. forces and the Serbians, and worked directly with Task Force Falcon. My brigade commander at the time, Colonel McClure, was tasked with bringing some senior Russian officers out to visit the Russian battalion. And on the way, he stopped at OP Sapper to take a look at the high ground overlooking this area of operation. And when he arrived, he asked the staff sergeant to brief the officers on what was going on. When the staff sergeant pulled out a map, the Russian officers got very, very animated. They were animated that an enlisted soldier had access to a map, that the map had operational information on it, and that the staff sergeant was able to make decisions. I remember having this conversation with Colonel McClure when he came back to our talk after that visit. And he was just really amazed by the fact that only 06s and above at that time had access to a map. I think this may still be the case when you talk about the Ukraine conflict, when we talk about the Ukrainians putting on social media the captured maps. I think that was basically the Ukrainians telling the Russians that they got a general officer or some high-ranking officer because they got the maps. So to answer your question, what are they doing? What is the impact? I think the issue is, to what level are near peers distributing this information to the lowest level? To what extent are they taking this information and handing it off to the lowest level so that people can make decisions? I think what we will find is a lot of the intermediate and primary objectives that our near peers pick in any fight will be tied to very obvious pieces of terrain. This bridge, that intersection, that train station, this shopping mall, because a lot of them don't have access to maps and geospatial information. Not because they're incapable of making these maps. The Russians make very good maps, very detailed maps. In fact, the American Army fought off these maps in the initial phases of Afghanistan. But the question is, will they be willing to give this level of information at the lowest level? American leadership model involves informing our soldiers at all level, empowering them to lead, and giving them the ability to make decisions at the lowest level. And I don't think that our near peers can do that or are willing to do that. So I think that gives us a leg up when we talk about facing off with the near peer in the operational environment and what geospatial information will bring to the fight. I think a good example of this is the Irpin River in the Ukraine. When the Russians came down out of Belarus from the northwest through the airfield, they're going to cross the Irpin River into Kyiv to decapitate the Zelensky government. that drop bridge along the Irpin River and the blown flood control measures along the Irpin River that we saw on CNN. You may have seen various CNN reporters or news reporters standing at this drop bridge while people were crossing it, climbing over the wreckage of the bridge. It was that bridge that prevented that 70-kilometer convoy of Russian vehicles and equipment from traveling from Belarus all the way down into Kyiv. Well, there were other bypasses that they could have taken further south and west. There's another major highway bridge further north along the Dnieper River they could have crossed again, but they chose not to. So I'm forced to ask why. Why did they not continue the operation and just adjust the plan to come in from a different direction? I don't think they had access to the information. They just knew that the bridge was dropped and there's no way across. So I hope that answers the question, but I just think that our doctrine, how we fight and how we believe in our leaders is more important in terms of countering their geospatial information, because I don't believe that they're providing it to the lowest level.
Now, you bring up an incredible point, and it's one that we're aware of. Those in the know are very aware that, you know, the biggest advantage we have in the United States Army is our people and our leaders. And that's not true for some of our adversaries. And you brought up a couple good points. It doesn't make any sense to have the information if you don't disseminate it. And then if you disseminate it, it doesn't make any sense not to empower your lower levels to make decisions based off of it. So I think there is a distinct advantage there. And I think it's important to bring up and not take for granted. One last question on those same lines. So obviously they're able to gather a certain amount of data. Where do they rank, or how would you compare them to us in terms of their technology and their capability to collect this type of data? Are we kind of on an even playing field in those terms?
I think we are. Just having looked at Russian maps, having looked at commercial technology that is out there right now, just as an example, the Sentinel bird is a European satellite. That level of exposure of what's available in terms of technology probably drives a lot of what we would deem national technical means for each of our adversaries or potential adversaries in terms of what they are trying to achieve. Their radar sat, for example, will pick up C-band. So a lot of Chinese and Russian warship use C-band radars. And you can see that smear in the imagery wherever those two naval forces are operating their C-band radars. You can see it on Sentinel. That was in a Popular Mechanics article that I saw a year or two ago. So I don't think that these nations would allow for open source to kind of exceed their national capability. So we know that they're capable of putting satellites in space. So they're very capable, I'm sure. I just don't think they're willing to disseminate that information to the lowest level and allow junior leaders to make decisions about the fight that they don't directly control. And that may be a gross assumption on my part, but everything that I've seen doesn't lead me to believe that they're willing to do that.
Yeah, and that does jive with what we've been researching and we've been discovering as well. And like RG2 likes to say all the time, you know, when it comes to our near-peer adversaries, in terms of technology, we're all playing in the majors. It just comes down to who has the better coaches and players. And so that goes, you know, that's congruent with exactly what we've been saying. So, Jason, we're gonna switch now from the big questions over to the rapid fire questions. We ask these to all of our guests. They're always the same every time. The first one is, what's a trend or a technology that keeps you up at night?
Oh, I've actually been dreading this question. I'm actually really excited about AIML. I know a lot of people are worried about AIML and drones and AIML doing this and that, the other thing. I stay up at night thinking about the possibilities. I don't think about AIML as the endpoint. Give me this thing, it will do that. I like to think of it as the start point. Once we get some of this technology built into our production line, what new things will become available to us as analysts, and what new things can we provide people at the lowest possible level, whether it's decisions, helping them make decisions that are associated with their specific job, or just helping them understand the complex environment in a very easy to understand way. So I don't think there's anything that's really keeping me up at night that scares me. I think I see a lot of possibility. Maybe I'm just an optimist.
Well, it does sound like you're an optimist, but it's okay. I suppose the question doesn't necessarily have to be out of fear. You can be excited about something and it keeps you up at night, right? So the glass can be half full as well. Because we get AI and ML as an answer frequently, but you never know where the person's going to fall on that side. Is it AI and ML are going to destroy humanity, or do we see some
exciting possibilities.
Some bright ideas coming?
I see exciting possibilities.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Question number two: what's something about you that most people might not know that you're willing to share with us?
I've been a geospatial analyst, a terrain analyst for over 30 years. A lot of people don't know is that I started my career as a combat medic. I was a 91 Bravo before the MOS changed, but I was following in my mom and my dad's footsteps. Both my mom and dad were medics. My mom was a medic and a lab tech. She volunteered during Vietnam. She did 40 years. Active duty and reserve. She did 40 years of service. Between my mom, my dad, my brothers, and myself, we have over 100 years of service. And that's not even getting to my grandparents. My paternal grandfathers were both at Pearl Harbor. So the Army is in my blood. I didn't start out in this field. It was just a little twist of fate that made me switch from being a combat medic like my parents to being a terrain analyst and eventually a geospatial engineer with the Army.
Yeah, life is funny like that sometimes. Very impressive. That's fascinating to see how many of your family members had time serving. And 40 years active in reserve is amazing. So very thankful to you and your family.
Well, I think the only reason my mom retired is because she hit mandatory retirement age.
She would have done it forever, right?
Oh, she loved it. Now it's up to my little brother to match her feet.
Well, good. We're all watching his career. So we'll see how he does. You keep us updated on that. So final question now, and I'm sure you're prepared for it. It's usually the most difficult. What is your favorite movie?
So my favorite movie is We Were Soldiers Once, the Mel Gibson movie about 1/7 Cav. That movie, not only is it about the cavalry, right? I was assigned 2nd Cavalry Regiment. It was the Air Cav, but it's still a cavalry. But also, Major Crandall was a pilot that flew for topographic battalions. He flew Hueys with a sensor that collected aerial photography that was then converted into maps. We mapped Vietnam twice, once before the advisors went in and then once before the police action started. Major Crandall was, and pilots like him had fixed focal length cameras, which required them to fly at a fixed AGL. That's where he learned to fly Nap of the Earth and got his call sign, which I won't mention here. but yes, that's absolutely my favorite movie.
So before we let you off the hook here, you know, you mentioned that the Army Geospatial Center is there to support the Joint Force. How does someone get in touch with you? How does someone get in touch with your office to put in an RFI or to take advantage of what you guys are doing there?
So you can reach us through your S2 or your G2, your engineer, your staff engineer also knows how to get a hold of us. You can get a hold of us through the website. And we also have the Joint Engineer Common Operational Picture, which exposes dashboards for commanders. So the staff can create a dashboard to keep the commander updated. That's another website that you can get access to, the JECOP. And a lot of our data is exposed through that and our common map background tool on our web pages.
Outstanding. So we will have a link to the web page on the blog post that's associated with this podcast here, so you can check that out for all the communication needs. Jason Fesser, Army Geospatial Center, thanks so much for coming on and telling us about the Geospatial Center, but also everybody out there in podcast land, go look them up and they can take care of any geospatial analysis needs that you have. Awesome conversation, Jason. We're very thankful that you're listening and that you're on here as a guest. Great conversation today. And we want to say thank you for coming on and talking with us.
Yeah, happy to be here and happy to contribute.
Thanks for listening to The Convergence. I'd like to thank our guest, Jason Fesser. You can connect with us on social media at @ArmyMadSci, and don't forget to subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider giving us a rating or review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you accessed it. This feedback helps us improve future episodes of The Convergence and allows us to reach a bigger and broader audience.